It's the Burt Cohen Show. Dream of peace and hopefully avoiding war. We are going to look at Ukraine today, what the truth is, and look at some of the reporting in America. And they say that in war, the first casualty is the truth. Well, we are not in a war, at least not in Ukraine, at least not right now. But our guest today has been looking very deeply into the reporting by the mainstream media in the news of that we get about Ukraine, and found some real questionable results as to whether or not it really is the truth. Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is investigative historian Eric Zuse, the author most recently of They're Not Even Close, The Democratic versus Republican Economic Records, 1910 to 2010, and Christ's Ventriloquists, the event that created Christianity. And again, we'll discuss Eric Zuse's allegation that the news media is lying about Ukraine as much as they did about Iraq before we invaded there in 2003. Eric Zuse, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Well, thank you so much, Burt.
And the question, well, most Americans seem confused and overwhelmed by news coming out of Ukraine. Have you been able to cut through the propaganda? How have you been able to do that? Tell us about what you've done to find out what's the truth and what's not, your knowledge, the sources of your information.
Okay, well, first of all, Bert, I'd like to open by saying that the Internet is an incredible research tool, which is used by scholars in all disciplines. It's like you know, having access to the Internet as we now do, which we all take for granted, is kind of like having a ticket of admission to the Harvard University Library or the Library of Congress or something like that. I mean, it is like it's like a kid in a candy store in terms of access to source materials, and right. The great thing about it is that in the, for example, the news reporting that I do, I provide links to the actual source documents from which I'm reporting. Sometimes these are court cases. More often they are really terrific investigative news reports by other great investigative journalists, or sometimes things that have been uploaded to the Internet by just regular individuals who have seen remarkable things. Or, for example, when you're talking about the massacre in Odessa on May 2nd, which started the Ukrainian Civil War, you've got dozens of actual videos that were uploaded to the Internet that day showing these shocking events. It was the first massacre in world history that was captured from numerous angles in video and reported, I mean, available to the public to see what was happening, what was done, to see it within hours or just a few days of the actual events. These, unfortunately, are kind of like hidden by U.S. major news media. One of my recent news reports has links which directly link to or link to the links that link to these videos. And if your listeners were to see these videos, they'd be shocked. I mean, what's documented is, for example, U.S. State Department personnel choosing the person who would leave the interim government of Ukraine after having admitted only months earlier, a few months earlier, that the U.S. had spent more than $5 billion in order to overthrow the existing president, who had actually been chosen in a fair...
Yeah, it was a democratic election.
No. He was overthrown by the United States government in February of this year because, unfortunately, Obama has had, since he came into office, a plan to reassert American hegemony and block out Russia, surround Russia with U.S. missiles, and lock in for as long as possible in the future the U.S. dollar as being the international trading currency, which is so key for the owners, the controlling people, the people who control U.S. international corporations, basically America's aristocracy.
Right.
I mean, it's really an amazing thing, but what's happening now in Ukraine is of such historic magnitude. Now, a recent article that I did, which I suggest all of your listeners should bring up on their computer screen right away, is titled "U.S. Media Lie Yet Again." If you bring that up on your computer screen, you will see the report, and you will be able to link directly to the documentation of the key allegations.
Well, I think it's interesting how, you know, in America for, you know, 50, 60 years, most people have been reliant on the major news networks to do the investigation for us. And, you know, we sit there and absorb it like a sponge. And now, Eric Zeus, as you're saying, it's a different age. We can go to...
Age, by golly, Bert. I mean, and it's exciting.
Yes.
Because the public now has a way to penetrate through the lies.
Yeah.
I mean, like, for example, just compare 2014 to 2003. The vast majority of Americans were suckered by the Bush administration to supporting an invasion in order to topple a dictator who was no threat to us. I mean, the reality is that the United Nations actually had documented in 1998 that all of the chemical and biological weapons that Saddam Hussein had built up had in fact been destroyed.
Hmm.
This was not publicized in the U.S. press, and the American people thought that he still had those and was adding to that stockpile. And the Bush administration was even alleging that he was looking to build and actually had a program, which, I mean, although he had thought about building a program, he didn't really get seriously into starting one. He never actually started it. The Bush administration lied and said that he's building toward nuclear weapons. I mean, the lies were fast and furious. The U.S. news media were stenographic reporters from the White House. Whatever came from the administration was official. It was believed by the suckers, the vast majority of the public, but that's how the aristocracy works. They fool the public. They lie to the public. They buy the Washington Post and the New York Times, the control of NBC, for example. Oh, NBC. NBC is owned basically by the Roberts family from Philadelphia. They own Comcast. They purchased NBC Universal, including the networks, including MSNBC and all the rest. The thing is that When you understand how the American major news media are controlled from the top, basically by a group of aristocratic families, and they are interlocked with the banks and so on and so on, I mean, it is just, we have an oligarchy in this country. I don't get into documenting those in my recent articles on Ukraine because it's a lot simpler situation in Ukraine. In Ukraine, it's so raw. And what we have in Ukraine basically is that we had a staged coup which took place in the latter part of February, overthrowing Viktor Yanukovych, who was a moderately pro-Russian head of state, who basically compared the deal from the West and the deal from Russia, and he decided that the deal from Russia was going to be better than the deal from
NATO, et cetera. Yeah.
From Obama.
Yeah.
And Victoria Nuland, whom the Obama administration made the czar over Ukraine, told a right-wing group on December 13th of 2013, that the United States government had spent more than $5 billion preparing for democracy in Ukraine. I mean, when in fact, it was already democracy, but it was corrupt as hell.
Right.
So, within a few months thereafter, the results showed. It was a staged democracy rally in which the leaders of the right-wing parties placed snipers in the crowd, firing at this, on the roofs of the buildings of the hotels and so forth, firing into the crowd and being dressed as regular policemen. It was a staged coup in which the Maidan demonstrators thought that the regime was firing at them.
Right.
And there's actually an uploaded diplomatic phone conversation in which one diplomat, Payette, is speaking to another, Ashton, Kathy Ashton, explaining the results of his research into how that thing happened. And he himself said, unfortunately, it was our people who were firing into the crowd.
Wow.
I mean, and Kathy Ashton, you know, was kind of like, oh, well, you know, but...
Yeah.
It kind of like, well, let's go on to the next thing. But, I mean, the bigger event, which was thoroughly organized by our people, because we had placed them, now they were the government, was the massacre inside the trade union's building in Odessa on May 2nd.
And I definitely want to get to that. I want to look at some of the history. I mean, we, the people in the United States, saw what looked to be, back in November 2013, legitimate protests because...
Right.
People wanted, the information we got was that most of the people on the streets preferred to be more allied with the West, with the open door, perhaps, of the European...
Yes, and it's true.
Okay, then what about that? So was it a large percentage of the people, perhaps an active minority, that is normally the one to make revolution? Wasn't there some legitimate... bottom up, not top down.
Oh yes,
voice of anger from the average people.
Oh, absolutely. Because and he, I understand why. Yes, Yanukovych was corrupt. Corrupt as a sin,
mm-hmm.
And so were all of the post-Soviet rulers of Ukraine. I mean, Let's talk, for example, about Yevtushenko in 2004, the Orange Revolution. He was corrupt as can be, and. And, incidentally, all of these people, the presidents, the prime ministers, they are the oligarchs. they are the people who basically ended up giving to each other, slicing up and selling off at pennies the gas mines mm-hmm. in the country and the newspapers and all the rest. Basically, it was a communist government. The Harvard Economics Department had originally created the program of selling off of industry to insiders, and they did it in Poland. They did it in Russia. They did it in Ukraine. The results were the worst in Ukraine. But the thing is, Yevtushenko, who seemed like a great Democrat to us reading the Western press, actually initiated the program to idolize Stepan Bandera, who was Hitler's great ally in Ukraine and the organizer of the Babi Yar massacre of the Jews at the ditch right outside Kiev. I mean, you can't get more passionately Nazi than Stepan Bandera. One of the reasons why this was done by Ukrainian people
yeah.
is that they were even more anti-Semitic than the SS. These people were absolutely... There was a news story by a terrific reporter from Ukraine who is an American who happens to live there, George Eliasson. He headlines his stories, "The Nazis That Even Hitler Was Afraid Of." I recommend that story.
Now, that's having to do with Baba Yar, with the massacre in the early 1940s, which happened...
Yeah, well, it extends from then to today and the people that we have put in power in Kiev.
Really? You know, I hear the word Nazi occasionally, and I usually think, well, it's one thing to call somebody a fascist, but a Nazi, you know, that's pretty...
That's the strongest style of Nazi.
A fascist, absolutely. And, but these, some of the people, I mean, certainly the people who were involved in the Baba Yar atrocity were, extreme anti-Semites, and as you mentioned, there's some evidence
over.
That, yeah, and but it, how does that compare to today? I mean, I've heard the term Nazis tossed around a little bit, and I tend to be more than a little skeptical. I mean,
let me explain.
I'm just asking in the current alleged government in Kiev.
Yes, let me explain.
Yes, please do.
Yes, if you look at these articles, take the headline, put it between quotes and do a Google on it, a Google search on it, the Nazis Even Hitler Was Afraid Of, and U.S. media lie yet again, and then click on the links, and a whole world will open up to you of source documentation and of really great news reporting and videos of events, so that you'll get a different picture of the country that you live in than the picture that you now have. What I'm saying is that there is so much that is basically censored out of the U.S. press.
Well, yes, indeed. But what about the some of the new people in power?
The new people in power, that news story by George Eliasson is one, which I have linked to in several of my stories. And let me just...
Sure. We are talking on the Bert on the Bert Cohen Show. Our guest today is Eric Zeus.
The Nazis even... Okay, here it is. Right away it comes up. Right away. The Nazis even... And right away, it's coming up. The Nazis Even Hitler Was Afraid Of. Read that. Read that.
Well, how does that relate to, there was that woman whose name I can't recall right now, who the U.S. was hoping.
Yes.
Would, what is it? Yulia Tymoshenko.
Her background.
Yes. Tell us about her.
Okay. She was an ally of Yevtushenko. You remember the guy who was poisoned with dioxin, but nonetheless won the the presidency of Ukraine back in 2004.
I had forgotten.
Yeah, okay. And he appointed her as prime minister. And she, as prime minister, handed out gas contracts. That's how she became called the $11 billion woman.
Hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And her husband, Alexander Tymoshenko, he was such a criminal that he was even expelled from the country. And he was unsafe for him to come back into the country for a while. Oh, but, these people, they're gangsters. But the thing is this. She and her husband were directors of, I think, United Electric Corporation or something like that. It was actually the buyer of gas from Russia to fuel electricity in Ukraine.
Sure.
And she and her husband were skimming off billions in overcharges, pocketing it, socking it away in Swiss banks. And the thing is, okay, then she lost an election to Yanukovych. Yanukovych was elected the leader. He then promptly had, filed a court case to get back some of the money that she had stolen.
Okay.
Ukraine, look.
But how does...
Because you're convicted, which she was, doesn't necessarily mean you're guilty, but she was. The thing is, she was put in prison on a 7-year term. She was released 2 days after the coup, the February coup, promptly announced her availability as president to become president of the country. The Obama administration wanted her.
Yes, clearly.
She was too far to the right for the Ukrainian public because, it still hadn't broken up into two countries like it virtually has now. The thing is, it was one country and nobody in the southeast was going to vote for her because she had a reputation of being with admirers of, supporters of the Bandera movement, which was this incredibly intense form of Nazism extending from World War II. Mind you, Ukraine was, their history was split between the pro-Hitler side and the pro-Stalin side. That's it. They had no democratic history at all. Mm-hmm. None. It was Hitler or Stalin. You line up behind one or the other.
Mm.
Hitler continued after the war as a hero, particularly in the person of Stepan Bandera, who was his local leader, the leader of Babi Yar. And the southeastern part of the country continued with Stalin, and then the USSR became de-Stalinized, and then it was communism, and then it was, after communism ended, then we had the privatization and so forth and so on, but the people in the southeast were scared to death of the parties, political parties based in the northwest, which were Hitler parties. One of them is called the Social Nationalist Party because they don't want it to be called the National Socialist Party. Their symbol is based upon the swastika. They have a group patterned after the SS, which uses the SS insignia turned upside down. You can hardly make it more obvious, by golly. You can see the insignia on these news reports. Like, for example, I have my computer monitor right now. The Nazis, even Hitler, was afraid of. And okay, and then it's a long story. So you go to page two. You click onto page two and. I think that somewhere in it they've got the picture of the insignia. I have it.
Well, I'll take your word for it. What is now Yulia Tymoshenko, was, appearing on American TV.
Right.
How could, if she is tied with the Bandera, is that the word?
Yeah.
The extreme Nazis, how is it that, Obama could be cozying up to her. I mean, that just seems like a really hard thing for me to accept.
Okay, well, here's the thing. If you Google my name, Eric Zeus, E-R-I-C, last name Z-U-E-S-S-E, and then Huffington Post, you'll come to my page at Huffington Post, where I've had many articles published. They don't do my pieces on Ukraine because if that goes beyond the bounds of what the owners of the news media will permit to be
pretty inflammatory, really. I mean,
well, okay, it's yeah, it is, it is, and I mean, I realize that the pieces that I'm doing now go the limit, but on the other hand, look, it happened also with Seymour Hersh in his recent pieces. Like, for example, he did research which showed that very, very strong likelihood, this was, you know, in the middle of last year, very strong likelihood that the Obama administration was knowingly lying to say that they had clear evidence that Assad was behind the gas attack, the sarin gas attack.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They didn't have that clear evidence, okay? But then, early this year, Seymour Hersh did a follow-up story in which he basically nailed it down. Yeah, they were lying through their teeth. They even knew that it didn't come from
Assad's forces.
From Assad. It came from the United States. Here's how it happened. This is in his you know, Seymour Hersh's report this year. Mind you, he couldn't get this stuff published in the United States. It ended up being published by the London Review of Books.
Mm.
I mean, this stuff is so damning against the regime in power in the United States that it can't be published here. But here's the situation regarding the sarin. The Benghazi, Libya consulate was the collection point for the sarin gas stockpiles of Muammar Gaddafi. Seymour Hersh refers to the rat line, getting that sarin to our people in Syria, from Libya to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
We got it to Syria, to our allies there who were called al-Nusra. It's a group of Islamic extremists. Incidentally, al-Zawahiri has, he only recently said, al-Nusra are our people in Syria. The al-Qaeda forces in Syria have to follow their direction. This is from al-Zawahiri, by golly.
And who is that?
He's the leader of al-Qaeda.
Hmm.
He was the second-in-command right immediately below bin Laden.
Well, it is interesting that when you bring up the sarin, use of sarin, and I saw video on the internet that, boy, it did not look like Assad's forces using it. It looked
definitely not Assad's forces.
Right.
And the UN investigation concluded absolutely that was not an Assad attack.
So
that was an attack by al-Nusra.
So what has happened? Let's look at, I mean, we're talking about the American media being, as you said, stenographers just reporting what they're handed. And, you know, when the Bush White House wanted to cover up some information that they claimed about some information that they said that couldn't be released because it would threaten national security, amazingly, the New York Times went along and was cowed by them.
Amazingly, the New York Times, there was way back at the time of in the 1930s when there was a coup plot that was being cooked up by the American aristocracy to overthrow,
right,
FDR. This was in 1934, mind you, and to replace him with a leader that they were going to pattern after Hitler and Mussolini. And they sent an agent to Europe to travel through all of Europe in order to find out how those people had come to power and how we could do it here. He came back, he reported to
the people who hired him,
aristocrats of the country. The point is, it was the guy that they were looking to be the nominal leader was really a terrific patriot. He instead just very quietly assembled the evidence that they were providing him, you know, including he didn't really believe that they had the money behind them that they claimed to be. Then he found out that, yes, he was dealing with people who were actually from Morgan Bank and from DuPont, the DuPont brothers. I mean, you can't get close to the center of power than that. And then he went to a congressman, and that congressman put him in touch with John McCormick, who was powerful in the House.
Yes.
And McCormick established an investigative committee behind closed doors in New York City to interview people under oath, and the results were transcribed. This was not published for decades afterward. And then there was this great book that was published called "The Plot to Seize the White House," which was the first time. This was in 1976, I think, that the book was published by an obscure publishing house called Hawthorne Press or something like that. I have the book. I remember when I read it, I thought, you know, I researched. I went to the library. I actually got hold of the source documents and so forth and so on. I mean, this was incredible. This was gold. It was a very good account, and it was really well documented
and
sourced.
There is
it laid out the plan to replace FDR with a fascist leader. The thing is this.
The media was important back then, and they knew it.
And John McCormick said the face of the New York Times is black with Morgan shoe polish.
Ooh.
That's it. That was back in the 1930s. Who held the mortgage on the New York Times building back then? The Morgan Bank.
Oh my!
How did Oakes, the original founder, get the money to buy the New York? He had a Tennessee newspaper, by golly.
Well,
he wanted to buy the New York Times back in 1896. It was already prominent. He got the money from J.P. Morgan.
Well, I know that what you're talking about, there it is documented that there was, in fact, this plot. It is for sure. There's no question about that. But the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the Washington Post, there was a little thing called Watergate. They were reluctant to publish stuff because they wanted to make sure it was the truth, but they did publish it. And the Pentagon Papers, they published that stuff. There has been some degree of independence and courage.
Absolutely. And it's all, there's a lot of resistance to it. Actually, I think that you're first of all, the fact that on some details, the aristocracy loses.
What do you mean?
Oh, like, for example, the aristocracy didn't particularly want to overthrow Richard Nixon, but his
right.
operation was too sloppy for him to be able to salvage him, so they had to join in removing. The point is this: they don't control every detail. They control the broad outlines, and with respect to Ukraine, one of the reasons I love this story is that it's documented already in real time in such a degree of detail that's absolutely incredible. Like, for example, this. The night before the massacre, in which, as it turns out, 272 civilians, they were all civilians, none of them were armed, who were demonstrating for separation or independence, semi-independence.
Of
they
Crimea.
Didn't want full independence from Kiev. Were burned inside the trade unions building on May 2nd. The night before that happened, Christine Lagarde of the International Monetary Fund, which is really controlled from the White House, said that if the Kiev government cannot hold the southeast, then we're going to yank the loans.
Uh-huh.
That was on May 1st.
Whoa.
So, in other words, this is how big a deal it was for the Obama stooges to keep control in the southeast. If they lose control in the southeast, then the whole charade that keeps them and their massive billions of dollars of fortune in play, is they're going to pull the rug out, because you know, it's all a Ponzi scheme. Mind you, Ukraine is in debt above its ears,
right.
Drowning in debt.
Right.
And the reason for it is that all of this, basically, the gas that's just been transiting from Russia through Ukraine to Europe, with a toll being charged by Ukraine, that money's been socked away in foreign bank accounts. Now, okay, the guy who was the mastermind behind the May 2nd
massacre,
incineration of 272 people inside and surrounding the trade unions building was Ihor Kolomoisky. And, you know...
And who is he?
People, pardon me?
And who is Ihor Kolomoisky?
He was an agent of Tymoshenko.
A former
she
president.
She appointed him. Even though she didn't yet hold any nominal power. After all, Victoria Nuland, whom Obama made the honcho over Ukraine, chose Arseniy Yatsenyuk to lead the interim government. He was a banker. When he came in, he said, this is a suicide regime. We're going to have to do such things that are going to be very painful for the public. They won't elect me. I'm not looking to be elected. I'm looking to do the right thing for Ukraine. Well, what the right thing is to basically to get things in line for the IMF's loans to be paid back. Now, these were loans to the Ukrainian government, which were nominally to purchase gas, but basically the majority of the money went into the oligarchs' bank accounts abroad. And, for example, Ihor Kolomoisky himself lives in Geneva. He doesn't live in Ukraine. Well, he moved to Ukraine after his friend Yulia Tymoshenko offered him the governorship of a region in the southeast. And it fell to Kolomoisky to put the plan together how the massacre would be carried out in a way that wouldn't be easy to trace. And what happened is this. The regime bust in soccer fans from the Northwest who, you know, are very right-wing people. And there was a soccer match in Odessa. And the regime placed some provocateurs, they're sometimes called, throwing rocks and then shooting guns in the direction of the supporters of the team as they were coming out from the soccer stadium. The supporters of the team from the Northwest. And they started chasing what they thought were separatists from the southeast. And they were going toward the trade unions building, and other agents of the regime from Kiev were pretending to be who were stationed at the trade unions building, were pretending to be supporters of the independence people who were demonstrating there. And they said, "Oh, you know, we've got a crowd. There's a crowd that's coming. They're really going to be
dangerous,
doing terrible things. Why don't you go inside the trade union's building for protection, and we'll protect you from the outside?" And so they went in, and that's how they got to be inside the building to be incinerated. So what happened is that, with a few of the regime's people who were basically members of two right-wing parties, far-right parties, I should say, there was the Social Nationalists, really the National Socialists, mm-hmm. and then there was called the Pravi Sector, which is the right sector. That's the English translation, Pravi, meaning right. The thing mm-hmm. is that these two, the agents from Kiev were stationed to initiate the firebombing of the building and helping the soccer fans from Kiev to incinerate the building, you know. And so it seemed like that, you know, like these were not entirely regime people, but it was entirely regime organized. And it was organized by Ihor Kolomoisky, who has an interesting background. Forbes says he has $6.3 billion. The reality is you can't tell with these people because most of their money is in secret bank accounts. One thing's for sure, he owns the biggest bank in all of Ukraine. It's called Privat Bank. Another thing that's clear is that he owns more gas mines in Ukraine than anybody else. And the third thing that's clear about him is that he came to power by a combination of two things: his connections with the Communist Party, and number two, his willingness to hire a private army at his negotiations to take over companies. He had a reputation of basically moving his army in to a company's executive headquarters and telling people, sign these documents and get the hell out. This is ours. Right this very moment, there is a court case which is being adjudicated in London, incidentally, because the courts of Ukraine are known by everybody to be so corrupt that it's just totally corrupt. The thing is, it's being adjudicated in London. An oligarch by the name of Pinchuk is suing Kolomoisky for having basically done this thing with his private army and yanked a $143 million company from Pinchuk's control this way. So Kolomoisky has a reputation for violence. Now, one of the neat things that the establishmentarians do in order to smear over the reality, hide the reality, is they point to the fact, oh, Kolomoisky's a prominent Jew. Yes, he's a big supporter of Netanyahu. He's a far-right Jew. That's correct. So the question is, well, how can a Jew be a supporter of Nazis? When they are Nazis, because the National Socialist Party, they're on record saying that the Jews should be exterminated. Hitler was a great hero and all that.
So how, it's the question, how could a Jew be...
Here's how. The Tanibok, who is the head of the of one of the two right-wing parties, and I forget the name of the other, the one that was mainly involved in the May 2nd massacre. These people know enough. They're trained by the U.S. to hold back their anti-Semitic expressions, which they are on record as having made in the past. And as far as Kolomoisky is concerned, and there are some other prominent Jews who are very, very far right-wing and supporting the United States operation in Ukraine. It's more an aristocratic thing than it is ethnic. This is about money. It is not about ethnicity, except at the lower levels where the mobs are.
Oh, right, of course.
And so Kolomoisky, for example, is a big donor to Israeli causes. But he is as much of a fascist as they come. I mean, he, not just in his politics, but also in his methods. He is famed in Ukraine for his violent methods.
Well, fascinating stuff. You've clearly done a lot of digging. What about the mainstream European press? Okay,
good question. Boy, and I'm afraid we'll probably end up running out of time. I mean, there's so much.
Yes.
And I'd love to be able to guide the people to the news reports and things like that. But unfortunately, I mean, that's the difference between the written online and a radio show. You can't click on links.
How did the mainstream European press treat all this?
Okay, it's a lot more honest, but it's not honest. Everything is a matter of degrees. I would say that the European, generally speaking, I'm talking about the English language European, which is like, for example, Der Spiegel in English, and the British, The Guardian, and The Telegraph, do some really honest reporting. But generally speaking, in Europe, I mean, I would say that it's between democratic reporting and fascistic reporting. I mean, the fascism is basically controlled by the aristocracy. There's no real difference between oligarchy and fascism.
Right.
I mean, in Germany, the oligarchs were supposed to be basically Adolf Hitler made a big pitch in Dusseldorf in 1932, his last big pitch for money, which after which, you know, the Nazi Party coffers were filled to the brim. He was addressing the aristocratic families from throughout the country. The core thing about fascism is that it is controlled by the aristocracy.
Always has been.
Always has been.
Yep.
And the reason why the Ukraine story fascinates me, it's twofold. One of them is it's the great game. It's carried on to the present time, which is to say the battle between the aristocracies for control of, you know, for dominance.
Sure.
For dominance, global dominance. And the other is that given the existence of the Internet, it's the first one where you can actually see such raw reality right in front of your eyes, often even in videos, and sometimes these videos are basically just recordings of phone conversations. Like, for example, the time when Victoria Nuland said the EU, and, you know, the time when she said Yats is the man, that being Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Yats is the man who should be running the interim government. Those two statements from her on taped, tapped phone conversations, tapped
right
by the Russians, incidentally. But they can't deny that this is authentic. You know, they said, "Oh, it was patched together." You look at the video. You listen to the pauses. I mean, this is a perfectly natural exchange between two people in a conversation. There's nothing patched together. Oh, and Victoria Nuland didn't say these things that are on that.
No, she acknowledged that she did. Well, what does the report? I mean, there's certainly a lot more to talk about Ukraine and. But the reporting about Ukraine, what does that tell us about our own media? And Eric Zeus, what do you think we can do about it? And I imagine people would want to check out your sources and links. How can people connect with you on the Internet?
Yes, well, they can reach me at the Eric Zeus, TheEric.Zeusse, or they can look up my articles, like, for example, I have a whole, but they can, they like, for example, if you Google the phrase U.S. media lie yet again, open up via the links access to a lot of other stories that I've done and other great news reporting on the Ukraine coup and the massacre and the goal by Obama to crush Russia.
Yeah, and I find it fascinating. Just came over the wires that Obama just announced plans for a $1 billion initiative to boost military training and troop rotations in Europe, including more naval deployments in the Black and Baltic Sea.
Bert, we are living through history, and most Americans have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
They read the American press. They think, oh, Putin's a terrible guy. Well, look, he might be, he might not. But the point is, if you're, I mean, clearly Obama is.
Yeah, it does seem to be the case, unfortunately. Well, thank you so much. Very, very interesting. And, you know, we can't be lazy, but people are busy. And, you know, to look behind the news is really important.
We do. I mean, we don't control. This is not a democracy. Anyone who thinks that this is a democracy is...
Yeah, even Jimmy Carter has said that the democracy is gone. Thank you so much, Eric Zeus. Very informative about the lies that we are being fed consistently. Thanks so much.
Can I mention that headline?
Sure.
Google. U.S. media lie yet again.
Check it out. Thanks so much.
Lies in my mama's looks.
think he made the point.